So anyway, yeah, this is kind of an emergency pod. People we were supposed to do it, I think, had Mother's Day stuff to attend to. So I guess we are the ones who either don't love our mothers or our mothers don't love us. just you and me, we're here.
I don't know what that says about us. I'm actually doing Mother's Day tomorrow. So.
Oh, really? Is your mom busy tonight?
Yeah, she's pretty active in her church. And she works a lot. I mean, and she loves what she does. Don't get me wrong, mm-hmm. but like she needed to prepare for a meeting that's tomorrow. So she wanted to she doesn't like crowds. So she didn't want to do the whole Mother's Day crowds thing. So we're doing it tomorrow.
Oh, cool.
Good old Olive Garden. Taking her to Olive Garden.
Oh, yeah. Your mom and
her.
Yeah, your mom's the one who's like the Olive Garden fanatic, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's at this point it's debatable if she loves me or Olive Garden more. Mother's Day is just her excuse to go to Olive Garden.
Or
honestly.
You're just her excuse to order a second plate of pasta, which you can sample from without feeling like
very
a pig
possible.
Or something.
Very possible. Man, she can put those breadsticks away. Like she loves Olive Garden so much.
Yeah. Actually, just speaking of food, you know, food that may not be great for you in the Discord, just leading up to this pod, we were chatting about the McChicken that used to be now no longer. I don't even know if they sell it anymore at McDonald's. So yeah, you and I, we were reminiscing about the great McChicken and
yeah
I think it was my favorite.
It's an insane picture. It's basically a picture of a menu from McDonald's, probably like early 90s. Mm-hmm. And stuff like two hamburgers, fries, and a drink is like $2.99.
Oh wow!
Yeah, like Big Macs or like a Big Mac meal is like $4, $3.99. Supersizing is 39 cents. Yeah, it took me back. I remember those days actually. I remember I was really young. I don't know exactly how old I was, but I remember like feeling very like it was so stressful. I still remember it. Right, that's how like serious I took it. It's my mom handing me $10, a $10 bill, and then telling me what to bring home lunch from McDonald's, which was like a couple blocks away or something. Yeah. So it's me just like taking this $10 bill and just being like, okay, I'm on a mission. I have to do this. Yeah. So that, which implies that like you could buy a meal for an entire family. It was like the four of us, for $10.
What would she have said if you accidentally bought a McPizza with those $10?
What the hell is a McPizza?
Oh, you don't know what that was?
No. What?
So there was a time, there was a period, very short lived, I think. I think it was kind of like the McCafe. I don't know if you remember that, where I think this was kind of when Starbucks was really.
McCafe?
Yeah,
I know. Isn't that their like coffee menu? That's what they call their coffees.
Well, maybe that's what they call it now, but I'm pretty sure that I think this was when Starbucks was really taking off. McDonald's tried to compete by having kind of like a cafe wing of its restaurant, mm-hmm. like not just coffee, but probably a place where you could sit down and, you know, maybe read a book or some stuff like that. That was a miserable failure, I think. But an even bigger miserable failure was the McPizza, where they tried to, I guess, kind of turn it into a Pizza Hut like place. And I remember going to several family lunches or dinners where we ordered one of those big pizzas and they would bring it out to you. They would have the little, it wasn't like Domino's where you take it out from a box. They would bring it to you, serve it to you on like, you know, if you go to like a proper sit down pizza place, they'll put it on top of a little, it's
a
like
stand?
A music stand for pizzas. Yeah.
No way.
And I mean, obviously like, you know, it wasn't a, in retrospect, it was a terrible idea. I read that the biggest problem was that a burger joint does not convert to a pizzeria very easily. Like you need specific mm-hmm. equipment, and there was the wait times are apparently too long. I personally don't remember waiting too long for a McPizza. I actually have fond memories, but what do I know? I was probably like 5 years old at the time. But yeah, it was a thing. I remember, at least in Vancouver, maybe we were like the test market or something, but it was there.
Dang. No, I had absolutely no idea. It kind of sounds like they were trying to be Pizza Hut.
Yeah, it was probably they're just trying to diversify.
Wait, did you guys have Pizza Hut up there?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
Little Caesar's
was my
pizza place,
like the real Pizza Hut experience, though.
Yeah, because you know I kind of like lived in the suburbs, so you drive up to like a parking lot and you go and sit down in the like, pleather booths.
Everything
and,
is red.
Yeah.
Got those red plastic cups and the personal pan pizza. Yeah.
Yeah. The only, see, the thing is, like, pizza, I have fond memories of Pizza Hut because Little Caesars was the pizza I grew up with. That was like our typical takeout pizza. But every now and then, for whatever reason, if we stayed over at like an aunt's place or whatever, or because our parents, you know, had some event to go to, for whatever reason, that's when we would eat Pizza Hut. So I kind of have this association of Pizza Hut with something a little bit nicer than your standard like Domino's type of thing. But in New York City, I swear, the only Pizza Hut is in Times Square. It's those like really depressing Pizza Hut Expresses that are like conjoined with a Taco Bell. And that's no good. They don't even serve like a full pizza. I think they only serve like the personal pizzas.
Oh,
like,
we have those here too.
Yeah, that's no good.
No, I mean, I mean, for what it's worth, like, they're always on like highways and stuff. So it's actually pretty good for that purpose. Like, this is like a no pretenses. You are pigging out. And you're looking for the most effective, efficient way to cram as many different kinds of calories as you can in your body at once. That's great for that purpose.
Yeah, next time we go camping, I'll make sure to keep my eye out for a Pizza Hut on the side of the road and demand we go there.
It has to be a Pizza Hut Taco Bell combo.
It has to be pure Pizza Hut. Pure pizza.
Okay, you're going for the purest interpretation. Okay. All right. I'm going for whatever makes Adam yak again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And speaking of camping, yeah. I think that's a great way to start the pod. I found that death is not the end. I can welcome, listeners, to another episode of Escape from Plan A. I'm your host, Chris, here with Jess on this fine Sunday evening. How are you doing, Jess?
Good.
And as I said, this is kind of a last-minute pod because we had this whole episode planned out. It's been kind of in... I think we've been talking about doing a pod on like beauty standards and everything for a long time. And then there was this article that came out recently about this subreddit called How to Be Hot. And then you, me, Liza, and Steve wanted to be on it. But as I said, Liza and Steve had like Mother's Day stuff to attend to. So we're going to do that episode soon. Listeners, don't worry. You'll get that soon enough. But tonight, Jess and I will just riff on a bunch of stuff that's been on our minds, you know, because we always got stuff on our minds. You know, we were talking about.
That's our origin story. That's our origin story. Do you remember when we were like, I don't know if we should do a podcast because I don't really know what we're going to talk about. Like, do we while we're talking like 8 to 10 hours a day to each other.
It's been like 4-ish years going strong with no end in sight.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was talking about the camping thing. Jess, I listened to the episode you and Teen did on, I don't want to call it the Roe episode because it was more than just Roe v. Wade, but I thought it was very well done, enjoyed it a lot. And I found it so weird that Teen was such in a good mood. I was like,
it's creepy, right? It's creepy. Eerie. Like, who is this?
The scariest thing was when he started talking about how great law school was and how he recommends everyone go to it. I was like, oh crap, is this like extreme early onset dementia? Do we need a doctor? Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, but I can relate if you need help.
But I can relate because I also have been it's not just because of the camping thing, but for instance, like I've been giving myself a little break from writing, which means I don't have to get up as early in the morning. I don't have to, spend my weekend mornings, waking up earlier than I want to and, you know, going out to like a cafe and doing things. I'm like, okay, weather's getting nicer. I want to enjoy this, you know, this time. Some friends of ours have just so happened to move into New York City, not to mention the city kind of opening up again. Whether or not there's like some stealth epidemic going on, I don't know. I don't even know if anyone cares anymore. But it does seem like things are getting back to normal. And I'm thinking, you know what? 10 years from now, what am I going to remember more? Enjoying life now or finishing an article or a novel like a month earlier than I ended up doing. So I've been taking it a bit more easy, and it's been nice getting more sleep, going to the gym more.
How balanced of you. This is very anti-tortured writer.
Mm-hmm. And
are you smoking less? Are you eating vegetables too? Wow, God, what is this? This is disgusting.
I have to admit, I do have like a post-workout smoke.
It's all about balance. It's all about balance.
But good news is, it's been about a month since I rejoined a gym. I thought I would get in there. I'll barely be able to bench like 50 pounds or something. But progress has been relatively actually encouraging. But the last time I was at the gym, not today, but the last time, I tried doing a pull-up. I think I could barely do one. I'm like, okay, the pull-up is the ultimate sign of strength, right? It's like the indicator.
So. Yeah. Yeah, I can't. Like, okay. I'm not there yet.
Yeah, like I got a long ways to go. I got, I think at my max, I could do maybe 15 on a good day.
15 I was hanging out. Pull-ups?
Yeah.
Dang.
I was having dinner with our friend Biceps last night, and I asked him like,
oh, okay, there we go.
how much do you usually? And he's like, somewhere in the 20s, basically. I'm like, God damn it. Like,
God damn it. Just but fuck this.
I have no shame not being able to match a guy that we've nicknamed Biceps.
I really stuck. You know, I started exercising more too.
Oh, that's good. Like,
it's been good,
at
yeah.
a gym or like running or cycling?
Just at home stuff. I mean, I have a dog, so I'm always like walking. So this is like in conjunction with all of that. You know, and I started actually kind of nerding out about it, like reading actual papers on it. Of course, like this, I'm not a trained professional in this, but like stuff that I was reading, it implies that like it's not intensity. It's really about consistency and discipline. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to go to the gym. If you go to the gym like once or twice a week and then try to kill yourself, you're less likely to go back the next week. Two, you're more likely to try to compensate for that. Like you're either going to be kind of like broken down a little, like you're going to be sore or something. So you end up burning fewer calories overall because you're so busy like recovering from that intense workout. And you're just not, you're less likely to go back, do that, be able to stick to that consistently.
Yeah.
So like breaking it up and doing like manageable things, but over, like consistently over a much longer period of time. That seems to be, I've been trying to stick to that. It's been working out okay, I gotta say. And muscle degrades way slower than we think it does. That was a big thing. If you go pretty regularly, you have a pretty good, you know, level of fitness, and then you suddenly stop for whatever reason. It's not like the clock just resets overnight. It actually takes like a couple of months to see noticeable degradation of muscle. After that, what you're probably seeing, if you feel like it's all going to hell, is that you're probably like slowing down it, but you're not like eating less, so you're probably putting on body fat.
Yeah.
So you just feel like you know. Like the muscle is going away.
Yeah. My workouts actually never take more than maybe like 45-ish minutes. I have like this routine that I've been doing like first in high school when I was, you know, playing like football, our coach set a program up for us. I just keep doing that. It's like 45 minutes is a pretty good time. I know I'll never get like that strong from it, but I do know that because, you know, I've been kind of doing this for many years. I will get to a point where, you know, I can bench my weight maybe a bit more. I can, you know, do a number of pull-ups. I can squat this strength. And it's like, okay, you know, I don't need to get super jacked. And my workouts are never that intense. I'm not like dripping with sweat ever. But that's why I think. And even then, there are like days where like, oh, I don't really want to go. So if it were really intense, I think I would just not go. So this is a good like balance I found.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty much the attitude I'm taking to this. Like I used to like just be like, okay, I'm gonna just go crush this, and then I'm just gonna go crush it again. And it's like by week three, it's like, how about tomorrow, which turns into like months. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Yay us.
Yay us. So okay, so I just have a bunch of topics that I thought were, you know, might be interesting to discuss. I'm sure you have some too. So let's just like shoot them off in whatever random order.
I actually don't. No. I am so out of the loop.
Oh, really?
Honestly, yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's not like the stuff I'm going to talk about is that like that important to world events either. But I think they're just funny to talk about. Firstly, why don't we start with... Oh, that thing I shared with... See, I don't even know if this is real, but let's assume it's real because you can totally see something like this happening. That thing that somebody shared in our Discord with the teacher, apparently a very well-meaning teacher, who put up a whole bunch of signs that is supposed to reassure various, not even minority groups, because one of them is for girls. So girls aren't a minority, but very, I guess, marginalized groups is a better term for it. Reassuring them that, you know, you're not whatever offensive stereotype that people say, might say you are, but then it just puts it out there.
Yeah.
And the worst one was, to all the Latino students, you are not all rapists and drug dealers.
Okay, we have to put it in the show notes because I don't think you get the full impact without seeing it. But we'll just read it. It's first one is, dear black students, and black is underlined. They're like,
what? That's so weird. You know, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, like yeah, these are all underlined, like for emphasis, dear black students. In this classroom, your life matters. Like, okay.
That's not too bad, but it is rather depressing for, I don't know what grade these kids are supposed to be in.
Because it just invokes the opposite. Like, what the hell? Like, before the sign, did it not matter? Yeah, is it not going to matter when the sign comes down? Like, what the hell?
Or like, outside this classroom, my life doesn't matter. It's just like, why? Yeah. just the font that they use and just the general sense, it looks like, at least like sub high school. I think it might be elementary.
I know, but the cinder block walls are really depressing. So really, this is, it's, yeah, like,
if you talk about standard school, right? Public,
yeah,
school.
It's, yeah, like, dear Muslim students, you are not terrorists. Dear female students, men cannot grab you.
Well, that's okay. That's actually probably the best one.
Yeah, that's okay. Although, okay.
You should probably say boys, though. I don't know how many men there are around that school that are a threat to do that. It's probably more boys, like their classmates, mm-hmm, who do that. Yeah. Dear LGBTQ+.
And also, it's not that they can't. It's that they shouldn't. Let's be clear if we're going to get pedantic on this.
Oh, they cannot grab because they have no hands. You know, something like that. Yeah.
Like, God damn, this is a weird classroom. Dear undocumented students, in this classroom, there are no walls.
I mean, there literally is. It's on a wall.
This poster is literally on a very depressing looking wall. Okay.
They could at least make it a cool wall.
I know. Dear Latino, like,
exposed
parentheses,
brick. Let's get some exposed brick in here.
Yeah.
And then, dear LGBTQ plus students, your life is beautiful and allowed to expand past fake social rules. Okay, that's actually not bad either. Mm-hmm. It's a little condescending. Your life is beautiful. Okay. Thanks, I guess.
I also like what for the rest of them, your life is ugly. this one, your life. I mean, this is kind of nitpicking, but it's overall like what the hell were you thinking? Then, I don't even need
Asians,
to ask.
Asian, like, even, I think this is a, I think we're not a good even included. Thing that Asians, it's like, obviously it's not really a good thing from their point of view because it means we're not part of this special marginalized group, but the actual effect is, if I were an Asian student, I would not want to see whatever horrible stereotype they would reinforce up there. And you know what this brought to my mind? You know that scene in The 40-Year-Old Virgin where that Muj, who's like the older Indian co-worker of Steve Carell's, just starts rattling off all these like sexual acts?
Oh, God. No, I don't remember that movie very well.
Okay. So anyway, it's a hilarious scene. I just pictured like this teacher, like, taking an Asian student aside, like, oh, you know, let's say Timmy or whatever, you are not a nerd or a robot or an insect or a small dicked nerd or a job stealer.
Your dick is just fine.
Or a virus spreader or a gook or a chink. just rattling off every stereotype, and then the kid just like starts crying.
Oh my god. Yeah, shout out
that's
to
basically
CS.
That's what these signs are doing.
Yeah, shout out to CS in the Discord. He added, Chinese students, you are not a virus. Like, oh my god. Oh my god. I don't even need to ask the race of the teacher here. I think we all know.
Probably white, yeah. I mean, there's just... Have you actually... interesting question. Have you ever had a non-white teacher?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, let's say at the elementary school level. Let's say elementary school level. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I don't think I have. I think.
Really?
I remember the names of all my teachers. Mrs. Farmer, kindergarten. Miss Scott / Mrs. Thornton, grade one. Grade two, Miss Sawatsky, also grade three. Grade four, Miss Kavanaugh and Mrs. Cottrell.
Mm-hmm.
Grade five, Miss Kavanaugh again and Mrs. Isbister. Mrs. Chalmers, sixth grade. Seventh grade, Miss Mannanen. All white women.
Hmm. Okay.
There was like, maybe like a sub
so
was like
female,
some white dude.
All here. White. Yeah. Okay.
Which I think is probably typical for mm-hmm. a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah, most of my teachers were definitely female. Most white, I would say. But as I got like higher up in the grades, there was a little bit like my seventh grade teacher was like homeroom teacher. We had a weird system where like you would swap teachers periodically through the day. So you'd actually have like three teachers over the course of the day, which is, I guess, closer to high school where you have a different teacher for each subject. So there was a lot more diversity there. So like science teacher for seventh and eighth grade were men. Yeah, I got a lot more diverse as I got higher up grade wise.
Yeah, definitely by high school, you know, lots of. Not lots, but a fair bit of male teachers. My physics teacher was actually like a Korean Canadian guy, cool guy. Like, you know, he actually made physics very fun. And
that's cool.
You know, we had like I don't know Indian woman who taught us chemistry. Well, like a Latino guy who taught us Spanish. I mean, that's not too surprising. But yeah, so but I think definitely at the elementary school level, it is. Probably quite rare to have a teacher who is not a white woman, and if it is a minority, probably not a man. I think it's still very rare to have a male elementary school teacher, which is a shame. We always loved it when like there was a guy, what was his name, Mr. Clem. He was a man. I think for kindergarten he would sub for us, and he would sometimes bring his guitar and everything. I think we just liked having that like male energy for once. Yeah,
that's cool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, we have a, I mean, definitely it's important, but, I don't know. I think we have a weird thing going on right now where like, I feel like a lot of people would actually look a little sideways at a man who taught like very young students.
Oh, cause they think he's a predator.
Yeah. We just haven't, and
isn't
this
isn't so
just,
sad.
Like,
that's the first thing my mind went to.
Yeah. That's exactly why. Like, I mean, you're even in America long enough to pick up on that. So, and this isn't to like denigrate or underplay the actual like risk of, you know, predators lurking in our midst and exploiting the most vulnerable amongst us, like namely the kids here. But like that perception does kind of taint the profession a little. So I think, okay. It's a little bit like a dude who's like, yeah, I want to be a gynecologist. This day and age. I read an article about that. It's a profession like gynecology is like 90% female now, if not more. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually more. There's just a handful of male students in that pipeline or male gynecologists in the pipeline. And they're trying to being discriminated against or like people just looking at them weird and being like, yeah, on the one hand, you should absolutely. That's not great. You should be getting the respect due to the profession. You should be if you're doing a good job. On the other hand, it's still like, bro, why are you a gynecologist? Really?
Like, I wonder if it even pays well. Like if it didn't even pay well, if it wasn't like, say, like dermatology or whatever those like hot professions are, that's even mm-hmm. more suspect. Like why? Because I think the problem with male elementary school teachers is there is kind of a reason to be suspicious because it is low paying. There's no social. In fact, not only is there no social status, probably negative social status. Like the harsh truth is probably like, I don't know, if you're like out there dating and stuff and you tell your date, oh, I teach like second grade, she's probably going to be like, you know, oh, all right, well.
You get hit with a double whammy. One, A, like, are you a pedophile? And B, you're broke.
Right, right. So it's like in the face of all that, what could be such an incentive for a man to teach elementary school? So the natural assumption would be, oh, he must have a thing for little kids, like in a bad way, not like in a good fatherly way, but like in a pervert way. So the whole incentive structure is messy. If, like, for example, we live in a society where elementary school teachers were well paid, well respected and all that, it would make total sense for that to be a viable career option for both genders. But
yeah, and they'd have to be like, if you make if you make a profession prestigious, automatically you get to like gatekeep more. You get to vet who joins the profession more. So you'd hopefully get to weed out, you know, obvious bad faith actors here. We don't have that. Right. So that's unfortunate because, it would be nice to have more men teaching kids. You need that. You need that kind of that exposure to, like, leadership figures, especially for boys. I guess for me, it didn't really resonate that deeply because, you know, I'm a woman, so it doesn't really it's not like I noticed a noticeable lack. But for boys, I can totally see how that makes a difference.
Yeah, there's just like something I think I don't know, like your mom is never as scary as your dad, you know. That's like that, I think that's just generally the case. So, you know, you got some unruly boys, you know, like sometimes it just takes like a guy to yell at them to get them in line. And it can be a woman teacher can be the best teacher ever and everything. But it's just like, I don't know, just like not the same.
Yeah, I see that.
All right. Moving on. This story I found hilarious. Somebody shared it also in the Discord today. Props to the Discord, pretty much fueling this episode. Where would we be without you?
Yeah, let's do some attribution. So thank you to Cal, who gave us the hilarious misguided woke teacher poster. Thank you very much.
And this next thing I want to talk about, the North Star Boys. I think it was Paluo or Paluo. I'm not sure how to say his username, who shared it with us. So, I mean, this is hilarious. So these are some TikTok stars who apparently came to Times Square recently and caused some kind of mob. And I kind of know them because Philip and I, you know, we kind of just like to just see what's going on in Asian TikTok here and there. They're a pretty popular group, bunch of guys. And for the life of us, we cannot figure out what they do. Well, we know what they do. I think they live in a TikTok house and just do TikTok stuff and everything. But
okay, so they're not actually a real band. They're just a TikTok.
No. See, that's the thing. They have all the aesthetics of an Asian boy band. They all kind of live like, you know, if you ever see like a BTS type of reality show or variety show or whatever, like a webcast, it's like that. They're like all hanging out in the house. They're having like sleepovers. They're cutting each other's hair or jumping in a pool together. But so they're like a boy band, but they don't sing, they don't dance, they don't act, they don't perform anything. I think they just meme or they make videos. I just perused their YouTube channel, all their videos. They're quite long. They're not like actual like TikTok length. They're like 15, 20 minutes. All their titles are like the NSB boys go get their ears pierced or something.
Weird. So it's basically a reality show. For the social media age.
Right, yeah. And I just find it so funny. And I just imagine, I wanted to joke to Philip that imagine like he has a daughter and his daughter gets into these types of, not like these guys, but you know, these types of like TikTok stars. And I can see Philip just being so flummoxed. Like, what do these guys do exactly? And his daughter will be like, oh my God, Dad, that's such a stupid question. Oh, like, okay, millennial. Like, oh, what do they do? What is, you know, that's okay, so
but what
like,
do they
2000.
Do? Humor see, your doddering see, old
Jess,
father. What do they do?
That's a dinosaur mindset, you know, when people had to actually do things. Now you just got to be. And actually, you know what this reminds me of? This kind of is like, you know how in school there's always like a popular clique? And their mundane lives becomes your source of like entertainment.
No, not really.
I guess you were too above that. But for the rest of us, we all know that there are like people like, oh, you know, what happened this weekend? So and so, you know, they had this party and so and so.
Oh, okay, yeah, okay, I get
got
that.
Mad
yeah,
at, you know, hurt him or her. Yeah,
sure. No, I get that. I think that I understand that, and to a limited degree, I understand. I share. I get where that's coming from. But my high school is just so big. It couldn't really get that entrenched. Like, there were 800 people per class.
Oh, wow. That's pretty big. Yeah.
Like, people get heat stroke at our graduations because it takes so long to get through the names. Yeah.
God damn. Mm. That's not pleasant.
So it just doesn't create, it's not so like insular that there's like one defined like kingpin or a tight clique. There's multiple.
Right, but even within those cliques, there is kind of like a prime group that everyone just is forced to kind of be fascinated by. This seems like that.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
But on a mega scale where, like, if like the America was basically like a high school, these are like the popular boys of a certain clique or certain part of a subculture of the high school. And yeah, them hanging out on a weekend and going to the movies is something that all their fans take an interest in. And it's probably with, you know, social lives getting more online and every day, like, you're no longer rooted to your actual physical location. Your social life is no longer limited by that. So it's like, yeah, we're just projecting the same type of dynamics onto the internet. That's why these dudes who aren't doing anything are still popular the same way that the popular kids at your school.
So they live in this house. How do they get paid, or what's their deal?
I don't know. Brand sponsors.
This house must be owned by like a corporation or something, and they just rent it out to these guys, or like, what's the deal here?
Well, I mean, I'm no expert, but I'm guessing that, you know, they started off just a bunch of regular kids, and then they started getting more popular, then a bunch of corporations like, hey, you want to hawk this, you want to hawk that, and then eventually you get big enough, and you get your own house, and they're basically like kind of like living spokespeople for whatever brands are sponsoring them.
Weird.
And yeah, so.
Well, I say weird, but that's not any different than the corporate model that we grew up under.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like Britney Spears is some grassroots star.
Mm-hmm. You want to hear my conspiracy theory on what's powering all this?
Sure. Let's hear it.
I think I blame China.
Yeah,
see, this is China using TikTok to poison the minds of not just young Americans, but young Asian Americans. Because they know that basically American like science and technology, which you know, translates into like military power, which translates into geopolitical power. A lot of it is fueled by Asian Americans. Like, you ever see those like, you know, international math contests, and you see the American team is like all a bunch of Asians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they're like, okay, these Asian Americans, we can't trust them. We need to make them stupid. How do we make them stupid? let's let them aspire to be the North Star boys as opposed to, I don't know, future MIT graduates. And they're using their TikTok powers to manipulate the algorithm. And now every young Asian American boy is going to aspire to be a North Star boy instead of like, you know, the Intel math Olympiad champion. That is my theory.
Yep. That, I mean, you and Joe Rogan both share this theory, actually. I mean, it's kind of this like tracking sentiment on China is kind of interesting. It creates interesting permutations, but like Joe Rogan says this openly with his guests too. Like, it's not necessarily anti-China. I mean, in aggregate, I think it adds up to a pretty Sinophobic take on what's going on in China. But you know, he occasionally says stuff like you know, like you used to go over, you go to like Douyin, you know, China's TikTok. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how the content there is really like curated for a much different kind of society and culture than the one that's cultivated over here, right? So over there, and I have no idea how true that is. I'm reporting on what he is saying. Mm-hmm. He has his take.
Yeah,
on
I've heard
this.
That too. Yeah.
Yeah, like it's like kids that are doing like engineering or you know. Like astronauts celebrating like great accomplishments in society and, you know, encouraging kids to study hard and work hard and stuff like that. And you hop over here and it's kind of degenerate crap, like reality star content, you know, people dancing to crazy things, stuff like that. So his whole take, and, you know, I can see where he's coming from on this, where it's like, maybe it is like, maybe it are these platforms, it's a matter of what these platforms are designed to do. If they are strictly supposed to cater to the will of the masses, then what happens when the masses are just really decadent and stupid? Does that make it a bad product, or does that make it a bad society?
Yeah, but apparently China has banned minors from being able to tip streamers after 10 p.m. Or, no, wait, the way this headline is worded is a little confusing. China to ban minors from tipping streamers and watching after 10 p.m. Now, is tipping streamers included in the after 10 p.m. clause? Like, you're allowed to tip streamers before it? I don't think so, just the way it's written. I think it's just poorly worded. So, you know, it's not all, it's not like every Chinese kid is
so just
using
do your all your Douyin streaming to... and end it by 9:59. Like, who would do? I don't know. I mean, the minute you set, like, the problem with setting rules at a high level like that is that once you create a rule, you've now created a game, right? The game is to now beat this rule somehow to get around it. So, you know, so you got to be really careful about how you set those rules to begin with. You don't want it to become fundamentally like a useless rule because people, so many people were able to just gamify it or work around it. Does it support the spirit of whatever it is you're trying? Like, is that the right rule to support the spirit of the thing you're trying to push? Not enough people put thought into that. Not saying rule is or isn't that. I'm not in China. I have no opinion on that. Just saying, like, here, people throw out a lot of really stupid stuff because they haven't thought it through. And get surprised when people are able to just sidestep it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you and Teen talked a lot about, like, law school and just the whole system of law. And that is one of the principles of good lawmaking, is, like, you can't get too specific because then it'll just give people guidelines on how to evade it. In fact, this is a problem in sports where, you know, a rule is there and the best minds in the sports know how to essentially flout the spirit of it, but still be technically within it. I think Bill Belichick, the Patriots coach, was the master of that, where he would, figure out, okay, the rule says this. And because, like, American football is such a convoluted sport with so many rules, it's like, okay, if there's like a rule that says, you know, within like 5 seconds, you got to do this or something, you know, just whatever. And he'll make up some ridiculous way to interpret it that will technically still be legal, but it's just obviously not what the rule intended. But hey, that's what the rule says, and you're not breaking it. They can't do anything. Like, at best, they can just change it the next season. But by then, you've already won the Super Bowl.
Yeah, exactly. So it's worth putting a lot of careful thought into. I mean, stuff like the past Olympics, right? Eileen Gu was, she got roasted over the coals here for, like, and nobody could actually point to any rule she had broken. It's just a general feel. It just didn't feel right or something. Or, like, doping rules, right? I'm sure people are out there flouting those rules left and right. I mean, it's a measure of who can get away with breaking the rule once you set it. And B, it's how creative you can get in pushing the boundary without explicitly crossing the line.
Yeah, so, definitely.
No.
I think that's all I have to say about the North Star boys. I will have to say, though, I think they're second generation Asian American guys. As a fellow second generation Asian American guy, I can't help but just, like, as long as they're not being predatory or something behind the scenes, I'm just like, I just find the whole thing kind of funny. And, you know, I'm like, hey, go you guys, you know, like,
wait,
do your
thing. Are they kind of living the Truman Show life? Is that?
I guess
where
so,
they themselves are the product of entertainment that's being put forth under the veneer of, like, oh, this is their real, like, life.
Yeah, of course. They got no songs. They have no other type of output besides, this is us having fun. In the thing that Palua provided, there's I don't know if I can find it in time, but there was this thing. It was so funny. They're like, "What's your mission statement?" It's like, "We want to inspire our fans." It's like, "But through what?" It was just very
to do what?
Yeah,
buy an energy drink very, and chew gum. Like,
yeah, it seemed like very kind of like culty slash, you know, self helpy. You know, where you're deliberately vague because you're just selling more of a sentiment as opposed to an actual good or product or useful idea. So, but as I said, like, you know, as long as they're not hurting anyone, why not them?
No, why not cash in on the attention economy? Hope they're making bank. Yeah, why not? This is just the decadent times we live in.
I feel kind of bad for people their age, though, because they must feel some kind of pressure to also do that kind of stuff. Like, I'm like way past that age, so I'm like, I can laugh at it and just, you know, enjoy it from a distance, just these silly antics. But if you're like a guy that age, are you thinking, oh, damn it, I got to find my TikTok posse and get my own Times Square mob? And that's, yeah, that's got to be. And it's like, probably. It's not even, maybe back in the day you would do that by joining a band or doing some other cool thing or whatever. But this is just, I don't even know what they're doing, like memeing or coming up with lip syncs or dance moves that you're not even creating, right? You're just trying to do the trend better than everyone else. It's like, I don't need to live in that kind of world. So
I mean, it's a more crystallized version of the millennial side hustle culture that was going around.
Mm-hmm.
I know. I think it started pretty early on. Like, I think I was starting to see this like 2010. The idea of like monetizing your side hustle.
Mm-hmm.
It was always kept very vague. So it was really just, it was left open-ended. So you see like people like, oh, you know, Sheila monetized her, you know, knitting habit and all is right, now yeah. one of like Etsy's top, you know, sellers of cat shoes, knitted cat shoes, stuff like that. And I mean, like, it's, and looking back, it's like horribly dystopian stuff. It's like Sheila was having anxiety breakdowns at her big, from working, you know, two jobs and dealing with student debt. In the wake of the Great Recession, her stress relieving outlet was knitting. And one day she found the perfect idea. Why not sell her products on Etsy? And like, okay, all right. Okay. Be like Sheila, I guess.
Have you ever seen Julie and Julia?
Yes.
That's the plot. Yeah, that's the whole plot of that movie. Amy Adams' character, I forget her name. By day works in this like soul crushing telemarketing job, pays garbage, but she has her side hustle blogging about, you know, going through the Julia Child's cookbook, and that takes her into she doesn't become a chef. That's not what, but she becomes like an author and is able to quit her job. And that was the millennial dream. That I think that movie was set in kind of the early 2000s. And I watched that a couple of years ago, and it was such a guileless endorsement of that dream, that, you know, you can achieve your dream, maybe not right away, but you just blog and blog and blog, and somebody will swoop in and give you a shiny book deal, and you can quit your
crappy job. It's a Cinderella story. Yeah, and it's kind of ironic that it's Amy Adams, who literally did play, was it Cinderella or Snow White or something? She was a Disney princess.
Yeah, Enchanted.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there you go. So yeah, perfect movie for the time. That's kind of it, yeah. You work really hard, you're pure at heart, you know. You have a little bit of suffering going on, and then you will be rewarded with riches.
Mm-hmm. And not only riches, but like a very mainstream form of success. Yeah. Like you're not gonna become like some disgusting like Patreon king or queen. That's like for the Morlocks. No, you're gonna, like, you're gonna get written up in the New Yorker or something like that. So
yeah, it's really you get kind of whiplash if you think about it too hard. Like in these movies, they always follow a similar template. The first half of the movie, it's, oh, the publishing industry is corrupt, it's incestuous, they're outdated, they're so old-fashioned, they're totally behind the times. And then as soon as the protagonist makes it in that world, suddenly publishing is great. it's wonderful, and it's everything a girl should be aspiring to achieve. Like, which one is it? It's the same industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that movie also is like, the boyfriend character is such a jerk. Like,
I remember that. Yeah,
he just gets like mad at her for cooking him all this great French food. I forget why he even gets mad. I think he thinks she's she's kind of just like losing focus on her. I don't know. It's just like who the hell wrote this? Like, who thought this would be? And I think she like stays with him or something. It's like, damn, this is like not well written.
it's an excuse to watch some food happen. A feel good story about food.
Yeah.
We all needed that.
It's APAM, Asian Pacific American.
Oh, just to finish that thought, though.
Oh, go ahead.
About the side hustle culture. Mm-hmm. I think in recent years that side hustle culture has morphed once again, I think to coincide with Gen Z becoming young adults. And I think now it's kind of clear, like the side hustle is a social media hustle. Becoming big on Instagram is kind of a dead end deal. For women, it's it's what, do you have an OnlyFans? And for guys, I think it's are you a TikTok, you know, dance star or something? So it's still the same like side hustle culture that the millennials got plagued with, but like evolved slightly for the times. With very defined funnels.
So you're saying now that whereas our generation, it was more like, okay, you like brewing your own beer. Now you can sell it. Now it's just more like you're just selling yourself.
Yeah, it's a more base form of self-prostitution. Maybe you don't even need to qualify. It's a different form of selling yourself. I mean, side hustle culture was criticized for basically prostituting out parts of your personality or your identity or stuff like that. But, and it's only a sign of how degraded the times have gotten that there is a silver lining to the millennial side hustle thing. It still relied on some basis of like knowledge or skill.
Mm-hmm.
Like Sheila, the proverbial Sheila, she knew how to knit. She was able to start a business on Etsy, was able to market and deliver products and cultivate happy customers and leveraged all that to become a successful small businesswoman, selling knitted cat hats. You know, Joe, the former banker who decided to give it all up, quit his job and go become a brewer in Oregon. That's still a skill that he had to leverage to do all this. This one is a more pure form of just be hot on the internet. Hot enough on the internet in some way, and the attention and money will come to you. There's very little mention of a skill that you're peddling. It's not saying here's how you can use TikTok to promote your cat hat business. It's you are selling yourself.
Oh, you can be hot and or you can be very hectoring. There's a lucrative industry in scolding people. With infographics and TikToks about what they shouldn't do and all that. I guess it's for among us who may be more let's say aesthetically disadvantaged. Maybe that's the only other route. But yeah, you're right. In fact, I think if you tried peddling a skill, people would be like, "You fucking elitist." I don't know. I think
yeah,
some
I've
people
seen that. Actually. I started following some like 3D printers. Like, I was thinking of getting back into like 3D printing. You know, see where that stuff is. You know, so I was doing research on like printers and good practices software. It gets ugly. He was talking about like, oh, this is ableism. Not everyone's
able
to do this.
Whoa. Like 3D printing is ableism.
Yeah, with these like, I mean, to be fair, there is a high barrier to entry. You do have to have knowledge, right? And a lot of the materials that you need to get started do take money if you don't have access to like a lot of libraries. And here's the public service announcement for this episode. If you live in a big city, your public library probably has 3D printers or access to them for you or your kids to be able to learn how to do this. So if you live in a big metropolis, look that up. If it's something that you're interested in, chances are there's going to be a resource available that doesn't require you to put up like thousands of dollars to buy your own printer when you don't know anything about the field. So that being said, if you do want to jump into it, like I wanted to look it up so I could buy my own printer, stuff like that. And then, so you come across like these makers doing stuff and, it gets really contentious. People accusing people of like, this is like elitism or ableism, like especially when creators are like, oh, anybody can do this. Like, this is ableist. I have ADHD. So this is ableism to say that anyone can do this because I can't. Like, okay. We've hit a new low on this, honestly. Somebody was doing, I forget what it was. I think it was pottery or something. And it's a retired woman who's just sharing her hobby, which is like pottery or glass blowing or something like that. And then, you know, the comments get really snarky. Like, most of them are nice, to be fair. And then some will be like, oh, God, it must be so nice to be to have all this time and money to be able to indulge in expensive little hobbies like that. How it like kind of implying that she's showing off by putting it on TikTok.
Back to the 3D printing thing. Are these people like selling what they're printing?
Some people are. A lot of people are real, like, open source fans. I don't know what to call them. Like, people who believe in the, like, open source products. So, open sourcing knowledge, tools, software, skills, stuff like that. So, a lot of people are doing this for free.
Oh, okay. So, they're like, even better than selling, they're, like, say, I don't know how 3D printers work, but let's say they map out how to 3D print a pen. And they're just giving this away for free.
Yeah, so they'll sell. So they'll just give like a lot of the like some of them do sell stuff, right? Like artists, 3D artists, they'll sell the products of their work. And obviously, it's so intricate that it almost wouldn't like. Oh, yeah, that's different, right? But a lot of like tech, like 3D people in tech, right? They'll do something like really cool stuff, like out of date consoles, right? Or just out of date tech. Something breaks, it's not easy to find a replacement part, or it's prohibitively expensive. So they'll do stuff like, "Hey guys, this is my blueprint for printing this weird arcane little like holder for this one little like chip in the Nintendo, I don't know, in the Sega Genesis or something." Stuff like that. And you know, a lot of these people, you know, they'll just give help out for free. So other 3D people in the 3D printing community will be like, "Hey, I'm having a problem with this," and they'll spend a lot of time like troubleshooting or teaching them best practices, stuff like that. Overall, a really wholesome community. It's just when they run into, but A, the numbers never get as big as like the girls doing lipstick, like doing makeup on TikTok or doing dances. Yeah. The numbers just never approach that, and when it gets contentious, it gets really contentious.
Yeah, I mean, I ask about the selling thing because if it is indeed a high barrier of entry, shouldn't you be thankful that these people have taken up the cost to do that? I mean, that's the whole reason why we don't all want to make our own food or grow our own food or blow our own glassware or something. Like, no, if we all did it, it would take up too much time and money. So we like let a few people who want to do that for their own reasons, and we're like, "Oh, thanks for doing that, at least if it's high quality. If it's bad quality, we're like, get the fuck out of here." But I think it shows that that kind of like resentment and like just disrespect of skill, because it's like what we are all seeking in this whole like online sphere is not really we want to get an object or we want to learn something, is that we want to feel like we matter. And the only way you can do that is to become like an online star. And if you are in my way by being too good at something, you are now in my way of becoming some like, I don't know, social media maven or something. And I think it's, and I've said this a lot in previous episodes, I think it's because, you know, the as the world gets bigger, you just get swallowed up in it. You just become more and more of a nobody. At least when, you know, we were talking about high schools, like you could at least, those were your boundaries and it was manageable. Like it made sense to you. But now it's like you could be like competing with somebody halfway around the world and it's really scary. And the only way to feel like you're not just gonna get drowned out as just a faceless ant in this like ant colony that we all live in is to get some followers and at least get people pretending they like you in some way or even love you. And if you don't, actually there's a book I read a long time ago. It's called Fame Junkie. And I really enjoyed it. And a lot of the things I read in it stayed with me. And it was about these very scammy so-called talent agencies and schools that would sell these dreams to little kids. About if you come here, you can become a child star and you can make a lot of money and you can go to the Oscars and when people still want to go to the Oscars, you know, stuff like that. And they said like that generally the demographic that came to these schools are often kids who are kind of like lower class. So, you know, they dreamed of wealth, but also a lot of them just felt very unloved. Like their parents were too busy, or maybe they were just crappy parents and they just like didn't really nurture them or whatever. So they thought the only way they could feel like a somebody was to imagine having this audience with whom it would be a very one-way relationship. Like they would adore me, but I wouldn't even know they existed. And if they died, I wouldn't know. But if I happened to stub my toe, it would make the front page news. And that was like their fantasy, like compensatory fantasy. But now we are all like that, you know? We don't have to be from a broken home. We can live perfectly well-adjusted lives. I mean, you see this with, you know, like old-ass people, you know, millionaires, even billionaires making complete asses of themselves on social media because they need that attention because they feel like they matter. It's like, oh, this is very horrid.
Yeah. There's not, yeah. Yeah. Nothing more needs to be said about that, I think. It's just... Yeah, I think it's just nothing more needs to be said about that, she says, as she's about to say more things. I think you talk about it quite a bit. And so what I'm talking about is kind of an extension of the thing that you've been exploring over the years a bit. It's a degradation of a reclassification of what people value in themselves and in others. Mm-hmm. So I think you and Eliza call it out quite often in like young adult literature or like literature in general, maybe, where it's more about like the identity of who's writing it and their politics than it is about the quality of the product that they're producing.
Right. Yeah.
So what we see on social media is kind of an amplified effect, like a general degradation and devaluing of actual skill. Of expertise, of skill, in favor of fuzzier metrics like authenticity, right? So it's a performed authenticity, personality is somehow more valuable than someone who is demonstrating a hard skill.
Mm-hmm.
So the quality of the product matters much, much less than the ability of the creator to resonate emotionally with the audience. And that's a total performance. It's a total head game. It's actually selecting for total psychopaths. It's people who can put on a very, very polished public performance of personal identity and authenticity. But by definition, if you're putting on a performance, how authentic could it really be? So I think we're selecting for sociopaths at nearly every level of society.
Oh yeah, even more so. I think this little thing that I shared with some people today taps into this. But there was an article. I mean, not like a mainstream article. I forget what publication it was in. But it called for J.K. Rowling to hand over the Harry Potter franchise to her fandom.
What?
Yeah, because they were like...
Just turn over copyright?
Kind of just like, I guess, give the rights to the IP to a better steward of her own work while she's still alive. And she's not like senile. She's still in her mental and creative prime.
Well, and that doesn't matter. Like...
And I thought that was so disrespectful. I mean, like, say what you will about Harry Potter and its literary merit. You might even think J.K. Rowling is not a very good writer, but whatever. It's like, but she's the one who created all this. It was her skill, as we're talking about. And for this person, and I know this person's like, it wasn't some freakazoid with some lone wolf type of opinion. I think this is a somewhat popular opinion among the, you know, rabid anti-Rowling people. Like, yeah, it doesn't matter if she created it. It belongs to us now because I guess we love it so much. It belongs to us. And it was just, and maybe one thing, I would have so much respect for it if they just said, you know what, I'm going to burn all my Harry Potter books. I'm gonna like scrape off this tattoo I got. I'm actually just going to go read Discworld or some other fantasy series. That's actually doing what's most in your power as a reader or consumer. But to be like, no, we're just going to take the thing you created and you don't get to do it anymore because it's just... Any comments?
That's so nuts. I mean, I had problems with the Harry Potter franchise from the beginning, actually. I think I was a little older when I came into it. I was in college when I read the books. Mm-hmm. I think most of them had actually come out. I think everything but the last one had already come out by the time I read the first one. So I think coming into a little older gave me a little bit more perspective. Mm-hmm. They're very fun. right? In the sense that it's very creative writing, very, very good, like intricate world building, very immersive, you know, very dynamic. And then you just, but then you look at the rules of the world that she created, and it's truly weird.
Yeah,
and I think in recent years, it's a feudal society, right?
Society, but it has modern technology. I don't know why the Muggles don't just nuke them. Like, would that like win them the war? I don't know. The wizards don't seem that powerful.
I just felt very, very awkward. I mean, there's characters that just basically exist in the book to be bullied, like bullied badly too, might I add. Just a lot of it is really catty and petty, and it just didn't resonate with me. And I mean, there's literally slaves in the book.
Yeah.
Literally slaves. I mean, this was the height of like Potter mania. So it's not like, I didn't open my mouth about this. I just felt like this was just a misread on my part. I enjoyed the books, by the way. Don't get me wrong. And it's just in recent years when Rowling started to get hate for her transphobia online that people started to unpack it. And part of me kind of wonders, like, would you have picked up on the bad themes in Harry Potter if Rowling had kept her mouth shut? And the answer to that is no.
For myself, I can definitely say yes. And I know this because sometime in college, because I was so cool, I wrote a whole Facebook essay about the things that were messed up with the Harry Potter world. Some of the things I remember were like, okay, it seems like Hogwarts, the class sizes there seem very small. Everyone seems to marry their high school sweethearts. And I was just like, this seems very incestuous. You're probably, I don't think people are making wise decisions. I think I said other things about, probably like the fact that nobody learns anything about, like, say, math or logical deduction or chemistry or anything. It's like, they're just like, you know, how do they even count coins? Like, do they even have, what kind of numerical system do they use, and when do they learn it? Is there an elementary school that they go to? Because, you know, Hogwarts doesn't start until they're, what, 12 or something? So I wrote an article like that, and that was when J.K. Rowling was still universally beloved. So I can proudly say for myself, I saw through the bullshit early on.
Yay us. It just didn't strike me as like just to see the like groveling, the characters that just basically exist to live terrible lives, the bad dynamics. This one magic kid just somehow wins everything nearly effortlessly, but while keeping his hands clean. If there's dirty work to be done, the universe colludes to make sure that he is morally impeccable.
Also, like, Harry's only good at Quidditch because he only always has the best broomstick. What the fuck kind of bullshit is that? It's like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of an equivalent. I don't know. You're playing like polo, and everyone's riding like donkeys, and you get the thoroughbred. It's just like, that's not fair.
Yeah. So it's just a weird stack of, rules that this universe is built on that didn't really, and also they're like, oh yeah, Cho Chang, like that honestly was like the least problematic part of the book, honestly. That didn't even hit my register. But if she hadn't come out as being against like trans people, nobody would really have examined the Harry Potter universe that closely. So, you know, when they say like, oh, they want her to divest from it, basically, so that this beautiful, pure work she was somehow able to create should be restored to its full glory, unsullied by its creator. You're kind of saying you just want, you're kind of rejecting the premise that, you know, a creator with bad politics could create, could create good work, right? And that's a lot of the ideology behind like canceling authors and creators, right? Like, yeah. Me Too, right?
Posthumously,
like Weinstein, obviously, you know, there was a real move to like redact his name from the movies he produced, stuff like that, like problematic authors, their works should be, because the idea is that they, what they did in their personal lives, of course, has some influence on the work that they created, or it's so tainted in some way that it's inextricable from the creator's bad name. So if you want J.K. Rowling to divest and you're suddenly just happy with that, I didn't read the article you shared. So I'm just going off of, what you said about it. If they're just expecting her to do that and then walk away and then suddenly everything is fine, you're kind of rejecting that premise, aren't you? Somehow this woman with like bone deep problematic views that should never be allowed in polite society or to have a voice or a say in anything or even ownership over her work somehow created this pure thing that's completely unsullied by anything bad and should be allowed to exist on its own merits. Weird.
Yeah. And I think that's that they got to reconcile the fact that people of their ideology, this kind of very, where they want everything to be like Aesop's fables kind of thing, and everyone has to be virtuous, like the creator. A lot of that stuff isn't good. I think they even have to admit it. Like, no matter how much, fakery they put on social media, like, oh my God, you know, I'm dying at some very unfunny comedy show or whatever, some drama. I think deep down they know it kind of sucks, so they gotta find a way. Like, how can I still enjoy what I enjoy, whether it's from some like rabid racist or misogynist or whatever, with still upholding my principles? I know I can just somehow lock them off, and it's gonna be okay for me to enjoy. And I think deep down they love like the things that bother I think us from the get go about Harry Potter, about how just. It's like the story's so like aristocratic, you know, everyone's descended from the right families, even the ones who aren't, kind of, I guess like Hermione's kind of not, but she's kind of the exception. It does play into that fantasy. I think at their deepest fantasies, deep down, they're kind of like boring, very stable, middle-class household, whatever they grew up in. That's not their real lineage. In fact, they're descended from basically gods. And mommy and daddy were wrong about everything. Like Dursleys. The Dursleys are irredeemable. Like, I personally love the Dursleys because I thought they were hilariously villainous, but they're horrible people. So mommy and daddy, wrong about everything. You're actually a superhero wizard, witch god. And best of all, you got to go to an elite British boarding school with other fancy British boys and girls. And you got to like hop and skip in your castle and you know, wear those nice sweaters and robes. And it's such an elitist fantasy. And I think your typical kind of like blue check liberal, who is, you know, the biggest stereotypical adult Harry Potter fan, that is exactly what they want. And that's why they can't let it go.
Yeah. I mean, I have respect for the ones that are like, you know, I'm just burning all my Harry Potter shit. I'm over that now. I'm also 45. And then there's, you know, I saw like spam from Pottery Barn. This is so millennial. It's a Harry Potter collaboration. So Le Creuset, the cast iron company.
It looks like a cauldron.
Yeah. They do like enameled as cast iron pots with like the lightning bolt, or you know, the little like handle thing is a what do you call it? The little thing that the little ball with wings.
The snitch.
So that's God. And these cast iron pots are $400.
That is such a perfect melding of, you know, like millennials now, especially of a certain like, let's say, social sphere. Now you can afford the $400 Dutch ovens and cast iron whatever. And what do? You meld it with Harry Potter. Oh my God, that's. I simultaneously wish I hadn't heard that, but I'm also glad I did.
Because it exists. It's seared into my brain. Not, so now
you I'm have not to, smiling, you have to hear it but too. I am laughing deep inside. In a sad, sad way.
Yeah. And they sold out in like a day.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that's the total encapsulation of where millennials are at right now. Harry Potter, Le Creuset.
Oh, Jesus Christ. We deserve like all the slander we get, don't we? It's just like,
it depends on who's saying it. If it's a boomer saying it, I'll go to the mats to defend millennials. Like, fuck you. You don't get to slander my people. If it's another millennial, I'll be like, yeah, we're fucked up.
Yeah, but you know, it's like the truth is the truth, right? Regardless of the messenger, and it may be more annoying depending on who says it, but if it's right, It's right.
I reject that completely if it's from a boomer or a Gen Z. I absolutely reject that. Well, look, if we're fucked up, the boomers raised us. So who's really to blame there?
Yeah. I was going to talk about that strip club that was apparently welcoming Ukrainian applicants.
Okay, was
again, I don't know how real this is. This could easily be Photoshopped. But the thing is, we've seen this before in other instances, whether it's like some Ukrainian woman getting raped in, I don't know, it was like France or Poland or something, to all sorts of other
fuckery. England had to do that whole thing. Like, okay, how about we not let single men take in Ukrainian female refugees? Because it's turning into a total shit show. Yeah. I don't doubt that if we are not there, we are barely a half step above this.
Okay. Here's like a little uncomfortable / controversial thought I had. Obviously, like, no, this is like 100% bad. Like, you know, women getting trafficked, raped, et cetera, because of this. But there's like, I think certain countries, especially a country like Ukraine, we probably see something like this if it happened somewhere in Asia, let's say like, you know, North Korea, Vietnam, or something. And there's this outpouring of support of like, oh, protect the women, you know, they're so beautiful and we need to, you know, save them from war and sometimes even their own countries versus the countries we don't do that for. Is this not just like basically like a geopoliticized version of missing white women syndrome where society suddenly cares, has an outpouring of concern for certain types of women that they deem basically like kind of sexually valuable versus not? And a lot of, for example, black women get really pissed off when they see like black girls go missing and nobody cares. Whereas we saw this with the Gabby, what's her name? Petito or something. Like a whole country was caught up in that and everyone cared. So I'm just thinking like, let's say, okay, so you see all this stuff with Ukraine. I'm sure no, you know, white woman's like happy that the sex strip club is seeking Ukrainian strippers. But there is this like international concern for like Ukrainian women. There's got to be some level of comfort in that versus, let's say you're a woman from some like poor African country and some horrible shit's going on there. There's like nobody's caring, and it's not like you want to see like strip clubs saying, "Oh, we welcome women from this country." But you know, you scale that down to a level where you get to like that missing white woman type of level of concern, people do get upset about that if they are not included in that concern. So I mean, do you ever think about that, like what just like I very do. Imbalanced levels of, you know, this kind of like faux fake concern for women over the world?
I do. I don't really know if I have an opinion on that necessarily, but just more a couple of observations. It seems like, there is a disproportionate amount of like sympathy and concern and attention given to, say, Ukrainian and let's face it, white Ukrainian women fleeing the country or trapped in the country. However, you see how shallow it is, because when was the last time you heard about like what happens to those Ukrainians refugees when they come here? Have you heard a single story? We are accepting Ukrainian refugees right now. Has anyone followed up on what's going on with them here? Like, I saw this like a month ago or something, someone documenting like, and this was critical of ICE, to be fair. I'm talking about how expedited and relatively luxurious accommodations for Ukrainian refugees were on the Mexican side of the California-Mexico border, and how Ukrainian refugees were being expedited into the U.S. While at the same time, like Hispanic refugees, I don't know what the word is for them, but like non-Ukrainian refugees, like people from Central and South America. They're in like horrendously unhygienic, cramped conditions. Kids are being separated from their parents, while on the Ukrainian camps, you know, families are kept together. They are given very adequate like food and shelter, and they're being expedited into the country. While the estimated wait time for someone in a different refugee camp is like months, possibly years. Like the author was talking to somebody who had been in that camp for like 2 years. Right. So they are getting a disproportionate amount of resources and care in being refugees with the political lens on them. But it's not very durable either. I don't know what happens to them once they actually get into the country. Are we providing them with free healthcare and rent and shit like that? Or what's going on? I have no idea. Or are they just kind of like tossed into the middle of nowhere to them and then told to fend for themselves? I have no clue.
Yeah.
While it's disproportionate, like I question the value of that attention overall. It's attention that's pretty much designed purely for entertainment value of people who are not refugees. So people like you and me here, we consume the story and then we move on.
Oh yeah, for sure. But I wasn't even talking about like from those actual refugees' point of view. I'm just saying like if you were, say, even a non-Ukrainian white woman, I'm wondering what, even if it's just like mild psychological benefit, like, oh, you know, women like me, we are valued enough to be headline news for a week or two versus being totally forgotten like other groups of women. Just wondering, you know, what that would feel like. If you could like simultaneously inhabit someone who is part of that concerned for group versus not. And if it is indeed worthless, like, because as you said, we don't really care about the refugees either. It's like, it's fun to think about them when they're this, like, you know, Svetlana from the village, who's like young and beautiful. Oh yeah. But you know, when she's here, we gotta actually pay to, you know, for her care. And, you know, she might not be that nice to us. I don't know, whatever. So the idea is fun to think about for like a day. And then we just move on with our lives and we don't actually care about the people. Yeah,
we don't care about, I mean, it has benefit, right? Like the Gabby Petito case, there's a reason why we know her name and not like probably like the 100 non-white attractive girls who went missing and were killed during that exact same time period, mm-hmm. right? That attention matters in terms of like being able to find, you know, bring to justice the people that do these things and then to hold them to account as they go through the justice system. Mm-hmm. So there is definitely benefit. It's just, from case to case, the value of it actually, it changes quite a bit. And ultimately, if it's all just primarily for entertainment value, it's not really that big an aspiration, in my opinion. I think it's a false, it's a false aspiration to pin your activism on. That simply getting more attention from the media machine can be a durable answer to any systemic wrongdoing.
Yeah, I think the temptation with that is it's one of those things where if you have it, you realize how worthless it is. But if you don't have it, it does seem it is kind of like, you know, it's like the older person who has, I don't know, done every drug and drank every liquor and, you know, fucked every gender, whatever. Saying, you know what, it's not that great. You should just like, you know, just get a job and live a calm life. You know, like, trust me, I've done it. It's like, it's not that great. You know, it's like, oh, if you haven't done it, or if you haven't experienced it, it is something that it's like, let me make that call for myself. Like, if I don't have that kind of concern and attention, and you have it, and you're telling me it's not that worth much, then let me experience that and let me make that call for myself. Don't come from a position of, it can kind of seem condescending. And then I think the second temptation is getting media attention, as difficult as it may be, is still way easier than actually solving problems like a refugee crisis or entrenched geopolitical butting of heads. So it's like, you know, it's easier to set a goal to something that's more manageable. Like, let's get like more clicks or more headlines for our cause. And then even if it accomplishes nothing, we'll worry about that when we get there. We got to at least motivate ourselves by giving ourselves an achievable goal. Okay, that got kind of heavy. We started off talking about the North Star boys and some silly teacher who, you know, God bless her. Jim was, or him, might have been a man. Unlikely, but probably. Now we're talking about, you know, trafficked women and such. So I think it's a good place to wrap it up. This is a really fun conversation. Yeah. So Jess, thanks for joining me. And as listeners, as I said, we'll have a episode soon on beauty standards and stuff, which I think will be a nice, I don't think we ever talked about things like that.
Yeah. We have a couple pretty good ones in the queue. So the beauty standards one, dating and marriage in the post-pandemic era.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like parenting. Yeah. Things like that.
Shout out to Teen who's headed down the aisle pretty soon.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I will be there and throwing rice or whatever.
Throwing rice. All right. Well,
all right. Thanks for listening, everyone. Catch you next time.
Right. Bye.
Bye-bye.